Hello and welcome to Daily Subversions, the feminist practice of everyday life. A live discussion programme to mark the 100th International Women's Day. I'm Amber Jacobs, feminist theorist and writer and academic at Birkbeck College, University of London. And with me today to discuss their feminist daily subversions are the writer, activist and academic Nina Power, author of the recent polemic One Dimensional Woman, Sarah Turner, the artist and filmmaker, and Frances Wilson, biographer and critic. So what could be a daily subversion? Certainly we're living through times of direct action, subversion on a daily basis, on a grand level in the Middle East, revolutions, but more locally here in the UK. Current student and anti-cuts protests and actions, which are almost daily, allow us to witness or take part in a whole range of daily subversions, from occupations of university spaces, or occupations of shops and banks, where protesters are turning these commercial spaces into alternative spaces such as nurseries or lecture spaces. We can see that these direct actions and subversions are against the dismantling of the public sector. But what do we do on a daily basis in terms of feminism? There's a striking history of feminist daily subversions in feminism, from the extreme interventions of the suffragettes to the bodily subversions of the so-called hysterics in the 19th century. What can we see as contemporary feminist subversions? Feminism itself is a contested term, and all of us here may have very different ideas of what feminism is for us today and how we live it or not in our everyday lives. I'm assuming, however, that we could all agree that feminism has always had at its centre the politicisation of the everyday. So whether or not we're caught up at some level or another with the fraught debates about what feminism is and isn't, what are we actually doing every day? How can we identify in our everyday, moment-to-moment existence any kind of subversive practices, however slight or seemingly mundane, that have as their aim a specifically feminist disruption of dominant power structures? So first of all, I thought we might go round and just ask my panel here how they see themselves as taking part in any kind of daily subversion. Sarah.
I knew you'd dump me in the deep end. Thank you. Well, my daily subversion would firstly never go to Costa Coffee, where which is, I hate to use the word mother of all evil, but in terms of, you know, corporate structures that we don't wish to appropriate as a model, Costa Coffee would be it. And there's something about riffing on Costa Coffee is also the use of space and how space, I guess, has been commodified in a particular way, and the way that we move and inhabit space. And Costa Coffee is a really good model, actually, because the way that they dominate, they've dominated economically and just completely removed. And they do it through this horrible marketing nonsense of, you know, this is the living room, this is your living room. But of course, they are. They're hideous capitalists that have a hideous marketing strategy and a hideous selling strategy. So there's something about the privatisation of public space in a particular way, and a lifestyle way. For me, I travel everywhere on a bicycle. For political reasons, but also for health reasons, and I can't stand getting on public transport in London, but I like to be in control, and I like to be in control of my body. And I'm cycling in London. I'm a Londoner. I've always cycled in London, and one of my student jobs was actually a courier. So, you know, from that, I've obviously been knocked off a bike many, many, many times. And obviously, it's always men that knock you off. It's normally cab drivers and people opening doors in particular ways. But it's about, as a woman in London, you have to use space quite aggressively. And just to finish that, because I don't want to hog it, but the highest statistic of female cyclists, of deaths, cyclist deaths in London, is of course women, because they don't cycle aggressively enough. Like, they don't get in front of other vehicles.
Yeah.
So you just have to use your body differently.
I completely relate to that as a fellow women cyclists.
Yeah.
But also avoiding the tube and the bus, you can also avoid the relentless and systematic objectifying images on the tube. I had to get the tube here today because I didn't cycle for various reasons, and I was just you know, probably naively kind of shocked because I never really take public transport, at still the relentless bombardment of adverts of women selling cars, naked women selling cars. I mean, so that's another reason why cycling is actually a refusal or resistance to being the relentless visual swamping.
And not interpolated in that,
Nina, have you got a daily subversion you'd like to share?
I suppose, I'm not sure I really like the word subversion, though, to be honest. I think it sort of implies that there's this kind of grand structure that you can just sort of transgress in these little ways, and that's all you can really do. And I suppose I'm much more interested in sort of political organisation on a bigger scale. So you precisely mentioned, like, the occupations and the protests and forthcoming strikes, like the University College Union strike, which is coming up, and also on March the 26th. The TUC huge demo.
Absolutely.
So, which is not to say that, you know, you shouldn't think a little bit about what you do every day, precisely in terms of being a consumer and all of those things. I suppose I'm quite interested in the way in which people subvert, if you like, their roles in employment. So obviously, you know, being a philosopher, you know, being a senior lecturer in philosophy, whatever, that comes with a certain sort of a certain weight if it's printed or if someone doesn't know you hears that. So I quite like disconcerting people by turning up and being slightly frivolous and looking rather young. And also just the fact of being a woman in the philosophy department, which is still a very sort of minoritarian position to be in. And I think sometimes when my students first come in, their expectation is that a philosopher is a sort of, you know, 50, 60 something, you know, crazy man with elbow patches, you know, sort of like a scientist, but, you know, with his head in the clouds. And I think it's quite important that there's sort of at least a, you know, representation of women in philosophy.
Absolutely.
And so I wouldn't call that subversion particularly. But I quite like riffing off the whole seriousness, silliness thing, because I think it's quite, you can get quite complex ideas across in a clear and sometimes humorous way that isn't necessarily what we're supposed to think philosophy is about.
But also it's the relationship between the everyday, the little things that you do every day, and how those everyday interventions link to the grander projects of social, economic and cultural transformation. So in a way, it's not an either or I'm talking about, it's the way in which theory and practice can somehow have a relationship.
Yeah.
And in a way, that's, whilst we're all committed to the sort of structural analysis of inequality and, you know, neoliberal capitalism and how it links to the feminist project, there's also a sense of what do we actually do every day, and is there a schism between our everyday experience and those more structural and grandiose ideas?
I suppose I think it's just difficult to work out whether what you're doing is subversive, because in a way, you know, sort of contemporary consumer capitalism can just kind of, you know, re-assimilate everything.
Absolutely,
almost. You know,
yeah.
Like people often make a big deal about, you know, being subversive, and actually they're just kind of, you know, maybe buying slightly different products or having a slightly different sex life.
Which is precisely what we can discuss. Is is there a possibility of subversion on that level?
I would say not really.
Not really. Okay.
I mean,
no, I sort of agree in a way, but we can come back to that. That if Francis, do you have any ideas about this subversion practice in your everyday life?
Well, I was struck by the term as well, and when you asked whether I'd join in this discussion, I felt sort of paralysed at first and thought, I don't really know even what subversion means for me anymore. And I think that the way I would describe it is a resistance. It's not even a daily resistance. It's a kind of life resistance now. I left my academic job 7 years ago to become a freelance writer, and I'm a single mother of an only daughter, and I don't accept money from my daughter's father. I live completely off-grid in a sense. I've decided to leave all institutions, and work and marriage and family, and I'm living more and more and more of a kind of a silent, cornered life, and I'm not sure whether that's a political or a personal choice. Economically, it's absolutely hellish, but I feel as if it's better than what I had before, which was another kind of hellishness. So I don't really know whether that's subversive or not, but I know it's a very different way of a very different set of life choices to any of my friends.
Yeah. And it was in direct response to actually functioning in an institution.
Yeah, I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand functioning in an academic institution. And I couldn't stand it as a woman. It was absolutely 100%.
Can you elaborate on that a bit more?
Well, I was interested in what Nina was saying about the kind of playing with your femininity and silliness and seriousness. Mm. And I think I absolutely agree with that. But when you're over 40, you can't do that. It's something you can get away with as a rebellious position, as a masquerade when you're a younger academic, and boy, did I enjoy it. But as I got older, it became more and more imperative on me to stick to the seriousness. Mm. And so I wasn't entirely sure how my masquerade was going to work now. And I realised as well that I was in all sorts of kind of conflicts in my department, but I recognised them as conflicts to do with my being a woman and being a particular type of woman and being a single mother as well.
Because I was about to say the difference between living in that masquerade situation in an institution as a younger feminist academic is very different, because as soon as you get beyond that age, you know, if you have children, like you said, you're immediately in a situation in an institution where you're going to be underpromoted because you're doing 3 full-time jobs, teaching, research and looking after to children. But yes. Nina, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, no, I take your point completely, and I mean, I realise there's something kind of, you know, not really perfectible that may what I'm saying. I mean, it obviously can't last forever, and you know, and I think in a sense, universities as institutions are becoming increasingly difficult to work in anyway. Mm. I mean, you know, I work in a post-92 university, which is on the high risk list of closure according to the union, and it's sort of become increasingly intolerable for anyone to work there, and these things do play out in terms, you know, and in terms of the old sort of prejudices and hierarchies. You know, when things get rough, you know, you suddenly start to feel, oh God, I'm being punished precisely because I am a younger female academic who can't necessarily stand up for herself in the same way, or doesn't have the same institutional weight as, you know, a male professor. So, I mean, yes, I mean, the serious side of what you're saying and the serious side of my claim about, you know, being a bit frivolous will probably result in unemployment very soon. So.
Oh, Sarah, do you have experience of working in your area as a fine artist and a filmmaker as having a preferable location, like outside of institutions? Mm. Or do you find, what's your take on being a woman artist in or outside an institution?
I mean, I totally hear what you're saying, Frances, and I really, really struggle in the institutional environment, and the kind of modality I choose to perform in the way that Nina's talking about is actually you get away with quite a lot with being an artist, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I am over 40. But, you know, yeah, I absolutely hear what you're saying about having to operate in a particular paradigm and the visibility of age, all of that. I think there's something about the otherness of being an artist, because it's like you go to, you know, I don't come from a middle class or privileged background. You know, I went to art school. Luckily enough, my generation, we had, you know, I would never have gone into higher education at this economic moment. But I was, you know, in this, you know, as a child that had that, you know, passion, that drive of otherness, actually. And I think that it is a drive of otherness, which is what, you know, it's the compulsion of being an artist is some kind of drive of otherness. Some kind of, you know, I knew that I couldn't be, you know, one of the, you know, at my school you were either a hairdresser or a panel beater, and you got married, and you know, you had 4 kids by the age of 25, and you know, that was just, I knew that I wasn't that. Also, and you know, as a gay woman, I knew I absolutely wasn't that. But in the institutional life, I know also, because I don't teach in an art school, I teach in at a university within a humanities department. So there's something about a kind of structural otherness, you know, that I know that I get away with it, but also psychically, because I know that I don't have anything invested in that structure other than the wages.
Are you happy in your work?
Well, as an artist, because I struggled, you know, I lived off my work for years, but, you know, in constant poverty and anxiety and despair. And actually, you know, it's very freeing. to just know that you've got a wage coming in. And I'm not a full-time...
Absolutely,
I'm a fractional member of staff. But I do... There is stuff that you can do around subversion, around mentorship, actually, and working with young women and, you know, stuff like that. And so, yeah, I think there's some value in it, and there's value in, like, simple human esteem of having a wage structure,
Are there any structures in place where you work? Because I'm interested in this mentoring system, because the sort of between women support systems, I mean, I don't think that they are at all institutionalised, or and we really can't take them for granted, especially in an institution. And that would be, you know, talking about trying to make subversions which are more lasting in terms of trying to restructure institutions according to political ideals. You know, does anyone feel that within their working space there is a support system for young women from older women, or a mentoring system? No.
Not particularly. I was just amusingly reminded of a recent incident in which I wrote something on my Facebook about, you know, a sort of fantastical campaign about how we're going to saw out the dividers and park benches so that homeless people could once again sleep on them. And one of my colleagues, a sort of female professor who happened to be my friend on Facebook, saw it and reported it to my boss. So there wasn't a great deal of because she thought it was I was proposing an illegal campaign that would get the you know, the institution into trouble.
So it seems that in these times when the public sector is being dismantled, universities are facing massive crisis, and women are actually I think it's fair to say the ones who are predominantly in the most precarious situation within institutions.
It's fatal for women, this whole economic crisis.
Rather than there being a kind of galvanising of a collectivity amongst women within institutions, it seems like that's not what's happening.
Although, I mean, I have to say, though, I mean, you know, okay, that's one individual, you know, silly experience, but I mean, in general, I think that, you know, the role of women in the protests recently has been amazing, particularly in the student protests. You know, you've seen a huge number of young women involved, you know, whether you want to call them student leaders or not, but the people organising the occupations and the protests have overwhelmingly been women, which is really interesting and makes a huge change. Like, if you look at 68, all of the political leaders we associate with 68 are all male.
You know,
we don't have any sort of great, you know, great female.
So how do you understand that?
I think it's a combination of a certain, I mean, particularly, you know, when I was growing up, we were always told, you know, oh, you know, you can do whatever you like, you're, you know, it doesn't matter that you're a woman, you know, you can get any job, you can be academically successful, you know, you don't necessarily need to get married or have kids or anything, you know. So it's quite liberating in a way, but at the same time,
like being growing up in the 80s
90s really
90s.
But the flip side of that was, you know, at the same time, you're going to have to be a flexible worker, you know, you're going to, there'll be no more jobs for life, you have to sell yourself. You know, so I think there's a kind of weird combination of this confidence, which if you, you know, which if you then say, look, you can and do be, you can be and do anything you want, but then if you enter a sort of economic crisis and suddenly it turns around and people say, oh no, you actually can't, and precisely when you get to motherhood and you realise, as lots of my friends are doing, that actually, oh god, this isn't really fair, and in fact we've hit something else that we're not really used to dealing with. But if, is that kind of what happens to that confidence when there's a political disappointment? I think so. You know, you give young women confidence and then you, and you say, oh, but hang on, all the things we promised you aren't going to be there. Then they're just incredibly angry.
So that anger is galvanised.
I absolutely think so.
That's
so it sort of backfired, you know, in a way, this campaign, you know, this, this model of
and in a way, what that also points to is the kind of very specific situation today of contemporary feminism having to take on the critique of capitalism. And as soon as those two things are splintered off, then we fall into a lot of dangers, which you outline in your book, whereby there was a sense that in the 80s feminism got kind of unwittingly caught up with the swallowed up, like you say, capitalism swallows everything avant-garde up and makes it mainstream, that feminism of the 80s and the 90s kind of lost touch with the structural, political and economic analysis and unwittingly maybe got tangled up with the ideals of neoliberal capitalism, which is catastrophic. But it seems like we're in a very particular situation now, being able to firstly analyse that and analyse what went wrong in the years from the 80s until now, and then also, like you say, galvanising the confidence that was produced in that situation for political change.
Can I just ask, because the three of you are in academia and I'm not anymore, What's the current understanding of what feminism is in the humanities department? Because where I was, when I was an academic, and I left it 7 years ago, feminism had just totally dropped off the agenda. You know, the female students I were teaching, I was teaching were sort of giggling, would giggle about it. Mm. They had no idea what a feminist was or what a political agenda was. Mm. But this was a very specifically provincial university. But what, I mean, do your students kind of, would they recognise themselves as feminists? And if so, how, what would their daily subversions be?
Yeah, I mean, I think quite a lot of my students would define themselves as feminists, and quite a lot of them have read my book and are working on feminist themes in their essays, actually. I mean, obviously within philosophy, but yeah, I mean, there's lots of feminist philosophy.
They would live as feminists as well as write about
it. Yes, actually. Yeah, certainly that's true for some of them. And some of them, for some of them, it would be about maybe, you know, their sexual identity, you know, if they're kind of gay student, gay feminist students, that kind of thing. You know, they're very open about it. You know, there's, I think that there was, in the 90s as well, this kind of ironic sheen to everything. You know, we were supposed to think that everything was kind of passé and politics was over. And, you know, and I think, you know, my sort of 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old students just don't have that. You know, they just, they see injustice and they're kind of angry about it. And they don't, they didn't have to go through that kind of, you know, awful sort of, you know, post-Berlin Wall, like, oh, hasn't history ended thing that we're all supposed to go through in every political direction.
So what have they inherited? I mean, who are their feminist precursors for your students?
I'm not really sure. I think, you know, maybe their mothers in some instance.
I would say, I mean, I my daily subversions actually come a lot in my teaching, so that all my teaching is informed completely by feminist theory and philosophy. And the students that I teach, and especially that I used to teach at Sussex, because I'm at Birkbeck now, so it's a different age group, but when I was teaching young girls of 18, 19, 20, there was initially a kind of feminism, you know, a kind of backlash, a sort of wanting to distance yourself from that word, which had got kind of mixed up with all sorts of cliches. And then as soon as you just got into the actual textual analysis, and it was really about language in the 80s and the 90s, you know, the turn away from economic and political analysis of our capitalist system then gave rise to a kind of post-structuralism where language became the most important thing.
Yes.
And these students that I was teaching were really involved in trying to think about patriarchal structures within language, representation, narrative, and how these things, cultural interventions, could try to overturn a sort of misogynist culture. And as soon as you got into that with these students, suddenly they were feminists, embracing it wholly. So I think that when there's this sense of the backlash towards feminism with young women taking on this kind of agency and not wanting to think about themselves as feminists, you just have to brush the surface and start reading texts with them, and suddenly they
recognise the feminism that was already there rather than having a road to Damascus.
Exactly,
experience.
They're tapping into all of the massive scholarship, feminist scholarship, that came out of the second wave. And so I think there is a legacy for younger generation of feminists to follow. And it's good to hear that your students are politicised already without having to go through...
They're almost all communists as well now.
So that means we are going into a new era where the economic and social political structures are being taken on yet again by feminism, like they were in the second wave.
Mm. Yeah. What?
I mean, I wouldn't. It's, you know, it's interesting. You know, you work in a London university. I actually work at the University of Kent, which isn't a 1992. It's now a, you know, semi-elite research institution. And actually, my students are pretty much very bourgeois. From, you know, tend to, you know, it's Canterbury, it's England's green and pleasant, really. You know, and you can understand why it appeals to their parents as well. In terms of that structure, but I have to say there is a new emergence of consciousness coming through, for sure, absolutely for sure.
Since and when?
Very recently, very, very recently.
Since this new government?
No, in the last couple of years. Okay. I wouldn't say it's just, you know, it's not since May. It's in the last few years.
Do you think it's since the financial crisis?
Possibly, yeah. I think it's the kind of feeling of despair that Nina's talking about, and the feeling that, you know, the wider economic picture as well, that, you know, that they are, young people are very much understanding that they are not going to be the generation who have more than their parents, that implicit progression in Western culture that, you know, that neoliberalism will deliver, and the understanding understanding that it won't deliver, actually. And they don't have a choice about going to university because it's an entry-level qualification, really, to, you know, swipe stuff in a supermarket these days. But it's costing them a fortune, you know, et cetera. Something is shifting. But the other thing about teaching in a university, you know, there's also... It's commodified, it's structuralized, some really quite disgusting stuff as well, the stuff that goes on around childcare, the stuff that goes out, but also from, you know, from colleagues that, you know, there's this assumption that, you know, that these, you know, obviously university lecturers are fairly privileged people, you know, on a fairly decent wage, you know, but will always go home to look after their kids at 4 o'clock or something like that. Whereas, like, well, and, you know, so, you know, kind of the gay members of staff or this, you know, don't, you know, they stay in care, you know, and there's a kind of real inequality that's structured in, it's a reverse of you know, because it's not contractual, actually, you know, because it's the cleaners don't get to go home at 4 o'clock. You know, they bring their kids to work, actually, or they don't work, you know. And so those kind of structures that, you know, I find them quite uncomfortable because they're never questioned, actually. They're never questioned.
They never have been.
Can I ask you,
I don't know,
more, Sarah, about being a filmmaker and moving the discussion on to representation and cultural production? So being a woman filmmaker in an industry which has long been completely, well, massively male-dominated, do you see your work as a filmmaker as part of a kind of intervention into a... as a political intervention, or you know, how do you see your role as a woman filmmaker?
Yeah, I do, actually. I do, and also because I came, you know, I went to art school. I was lucky enough to go to art school in that moment where I was taught by the first generation of women in art schools. And that, you know, that was a crucial moment, really, in the late 80s, that, you know, those women had really fought the battles.
So do you mean Griselda Pollock?
Exactly. Well, you know, she's a theorist, but I mean people like Liz Rhodes, Tina Keane, you know, Susan Hiller, who's...
So you went in at a completely politicised time where feminism was just infiltrating art.
It was at the height of that consciousness, really. And it's interesting now, a generation or so later, to see which women are marginalised, which women have been very commodified and are extremely successful, but which, you know, the older generation of women artists who were extremely political in the 60s and 70s, where they are, you know, because they don't, again, they, you know, it's a very hard lifestyle. It's not a lifestyle choice to be an artist.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but I was also, you know, I worked through the tradition of... you know, my mentors, and with the London Filmmakers Co-op. So, you know, it was also alternative structures. It was, you know, it was a synthesis of form and content, if you like, you know. So we were working outside of particular modes of representation and challenging that as well. But obviously, you know, that all literally kind of imploded, really, in this moment that we're talking about, that Nina's identified, and many people have identified, that, you know, the missing the moment of where identity politics kind of actually colluded with neoliberalism. So the structures that we fought very radically for imploded, really. So
that happened in the art world too.
Well, yeah, because the Filmmakers Co-op was the Lux, and the Lux Centre went down. Yeah. You know, they tried to squat it. I know that a lot of the equipment was stolen, quite rightly, you know. It's a lot of pub, you know, they took, you know, but, you know, not enough, you know. It was all around funding and a particular kind of corporate image, but equally, as a woman working in that, I mean, I'm not interested in, you know, trying to be a woman in a male industry. I'm interested in thinking differently, and, you know, like, I'm no longer interested in buying into those structures either. But in terms of a more general, if you like, subversion, I mean, I always recruit women,
right?
You know, in, you know, you'd said earlier, sorry, I'm the for the audience, that we have a male engineer in the room who bless him, but who said, you know, there's very few female engineers, and that's the in within film. You know, the women in technical roles and sound is the worst. It's a totally male-dominated industry, and it is disgusting going into it. You go into these dubbing theatres, and they literally have tit posters up everywhere. You know, I'm quite happy to look at a nice pair of tits, but I don't want to see that in my working environment. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to negotiate those structures. And it's awful, and it's a totally male-dominated industry. And if I've got a chance to use a female mixer, I will always, always do that, and I will find ways of working with young women in that role as well.
So on the one hand, it's the absolute necessity of improving the quota of women within the industry, not just being the ones that write the films and make the films, but actually who produce the apparatus, you know. But in terms of representation, I wondered what people felt like. Cultural interventions, perhaps, that on the level of representation, do people feel that you can make a difference? I mean, I'm just thinking of very small, going back to this notion of small daily subversions, how one incorporates trying to subvert representations of women. I mean, I myself do it every night with my reading my daughter's stories. I just, as a matter of course, change the characters round so that the active subject position that's always the boy is the girl. And, and I know that's just a kind of simple making the binary the other way around, you know, but it actually has a massive effect when you're reading to a small child Stig of the Dump, for example, or Enid Blyton, which I'm afraid, you know, are really good stories, whatever anyone says about the politics. Children really like the stories. But as soon as you make Jo Beth, you know, or, you know, turn it round, and or make Stig's friend Barney a girl, something happens to
it
the
makes
story.
It electrifying
and
difference.
And it's an electrifying thing. And in a way, when you were talking about, you know, little subversions don't matter, I sort of want to disagree, because I think those little subversions do matter and have a profound effect when you can edit. So in your everyday life, editing children's stories or editing, taking the male pronoun and replacing it with the female does have a profound effect.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I'm sorry. Yes, I don't really mean to imply they don't have any effect, I suppose, or, you know, that they weren't important. You know, I mean, obviously, I'm talking from a position of somebody who, you know, is sort of primarily dedicated to her job and doesn't have a kid or isn't married, or, you know what I mean? So, you know, I suppose in terms of social relations, I do tend to think of things through work and, you know, how I can improve things at work, maybe, or, you know, what difference I can make in the sort of public realm, you know, if I write something for a newspaper or something like that. You know, is there something inherently important about doing that because, you know, I'm a female philosopher and there aren't very many of them? You know, do I have a kind of obligation to intervene in certain debates? You know, I mean, obviously we're not supposed to believe in the image of the public intellectual anymore. You know, the age of Sartre and so on is over. But, you know,
I'm not sure it's over, but anyway.
Well, you know what I mean? I'm being sort of ironic. But, you know, do you know what I mean? Like, you know, there's something irritating about that model of a public intellectual, someone who intervenes into every single political debate. And I certainly wouldn't want to do that. But, you know, so I suppose... Okay, if we call that, but I wouldn't call it subversion, I would just call it...
In terms of transgenerational, kind of, trying to have a transgenerational effect, so going to this much-used model of the mother-daughter relationship, however unpopular and problematic that has been in feminism, it's important to think about how we do translate social change, and on a daily level, obviously through teaching, that's one obvious way in which we produce transgenerational change, one would hope. But in terms of daughters' representation, you know, there is something that you can do. You cannot go to the newsagent where your child is going to reach for the Doctor Who comic, which is practically next to the soft porn lad mags. You know, that's a daily subversion. To not do that, or to refuse the relentlessly pink, ridiculous clothes that are on offer for girls. Mm. And you can change children's stories so that the female subject position is active.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yes, yeah, so certainly if you're a mother, then, yeah, you've got a way of directly intervening and shaping, you know, your son or daughter's relation to these questions. I think that's absolutely right. And, of course, you know, everyone should think about that and think about what it means to read and represent these figures.
Frances?
Well, I'm struck by the... what you're saying about mothers and daughters. I mean, we are all daughters in this room, apart from the engineer, and two of us are mothers. And I feel that I increasingly measure myself as a woman and as a feminist woman next to my mother, it's very much a conversation. My whole life is a conversation with my mother's life and what went wrong in her life. I mean, my mother is someone who was instinctively bought, she was born a feminist and never, ever, ever lived any of her beliefs. She just was born in just the wrong era. And so I feel that the way I'm living now as a outside a traditional family structure and outside a traditional formal work structure is exactly the way my mother would have wanted to live. And I feel very, very, very pleased about that. That this is some kind of utopia, actually, for me, sort of, you know, being able to enjoy these freedoms. And I'm very pleased that my daughter's growing up in this kind of subversion. Right. You know, I mean, what she sees, and I'm very keen that she sees this in me, is a mother who is doing exactly what she wants to do for a living and earning her money for it, and is not kind of complaining about a job that she just can't stand anymore. And so, yes.
Can we have, we're going to have a little bit of a break and hear at this moment some soundtrack of Sarah Turner's film, which we'll talk about after we've heard a bit.
Yeah, and can I just say that, because I don't want to make invisible, the woman who did the sound design of this is actually Annabelle Pangborn. She created the sound design from the sampled films from that women submitted.
Yeah, so this is a film, a 2008 film for the Bird's Eye View Festival. Thanks.
London Victoria. This train terminates here. All change. Please do not leave unattended items of luggage in the train or on the station. Please ensure that you take all your personal belongings with you. Please make sure you have all your personal belongings with you when you leave the train.
Was the soundtrack from Sarah Turner's film Overheated Symphony, which was part of the Bird's Eye View Festival. And I thought maybe Sarah could say a few words about the film before we continue the discussion.
Yeah, okay. Well, just briefly, that year I had another one of my feature films was in that festival, Ecology, and it's a film that works with multiple technologies. So the festival asked me if I would work on a project for them to create, orchestrate an interactive mobile phone making project. So, and I thought this was a wonderful idea, so obviously agreed to do it. And then from that we created the theme of, I came up with the idea of working with a symphony, because I did like this idea of symphonic voices, but it was actually inspired by Walter Ruttmann's 1927 film Berlin Symphony of a City. So that was the main structure, and then we decided also to give it a theme, to, which was to provoke a response. And this was 2008, so it was leading up to the Copenhagen conference. So I wanted a response to global warming, so I called it Overheated. But I wasn't prescriptive in that. I think I used the words. Yeah, we said our theme, Overheated, was designed to provoke a response. So that response might be to fears of global warming or domestic frustrations or any situation that provokes heat. And that was open to women to decide. And then women submitted films on mobile that they made on their mobile phones. We downloaded the media over a period of weeks, and then Annabelle and I edited it live at the ICA on the 9th, I think it was on International Women's Day, actually. And some of the participants, obviously the films were coming from around the world, but some of the local participants came and watched the mix. So and we used a symphonic structure as well, so the movement.
And you can hear and see that on YouTube, by the way. Yeah. I mean, it really strikes me, the discrepancy between the sort of marginal filmmaking in festivals like that and the mainstream cinema, in terms of not only just representation of women, but the reception of films, which are just sort of reproducing kind of hackneyed old stereotypes of women. Like, absolutely, since Mulvey's intervention with her visual pleasure and narrative cinema, absolutely, it doesn't seem to have actually had much of an effect in cinema. Do you think that's to do with that neoliberal moment where feminism got swallowed up?
Absolutely. Gone are the moment of the great formal experiments, and although I still, I'm utterly committed to the synthesis of form and content, and that, both have to be changed. So I couldn't go back to writing conventional narrative feature films, which indeed I have done. But it seems to me there's always, you can have a subversion on one level. So it's, if you retain the contract of the genre, so for example a rom-com, you can subvert it with the content, so the genre is recognisable. So if you think a film which changed, which was quite radical at the time in 1994, Go Fish, Rose Trossé's film, which it's a lesbian rom-com, but it absolutely took all of the movement of a straightforward rom-com and inserted two women. So it's the same thing, actually. And a recent film, The Kids Are Alright, which it's a lovely film, I really really enjoyed it. It's looking at alternative family structures, and again lesbian parenting, but it uses the modality is a rom-com, so we sit within the contract of that genre. And obviously the economic structures of that film were, she's a very interesting filmmaker, Lisa Jolodenko. She's done some wonderful work.
That's close to what Amber was saying, that what she does with her children at night. She sort of reads the stories but changes the genders, just stick to the same structure.
Yeah, whereas the idea of trying to produce a new structure, is a real political intervention, is something which is much, much more gradual. Yes. But I still have hope for. Although trying to infiltrate Hollywood and mainstream cinema is another thing, but the idea of giving up is terrible. And that I want to come back to Nina. I'm feeling that there's this kind of discrepancy between what we see as the political and what we see as the everyday. Because I think maybe you feel that there's a big schism in that when and in terms of things like representation, trying to produce different narratives within film, for example, or trying to do daily, nightly subversions with children's stories, or the more political analysis. What is your feeling about trying to integrate those?
Yeah, I don't think they're sort of separate out in that totally dichotomous way. I mean, obviously they're on a continuum. I mean, you enact the change you want to see in your everyday life. One hopes. It would be awful if you were only interested in larger structural changes, and therefore you sort of thought it was okay to be horrible to everyone around you. And that would be ridiculous. I mean, there has to be some kind of consistent continuum. I mean, okay, if you want to talk about like everyday politics, it would be, act like the kind of person you would want to be in if you lived in a different kind of economic environment. I mean, something like this.
But there's this kind of notion of politics as being kind of the serious, weighty place to occupy, and then these other...
I don't like that distinction. I mean, sorry if I made it sound a bit like, this is all frivolous stuff and we should all just be organising all the time. But
we should be organising all the time and
as well.
Producing
the daily
subversions.
I don't think it's exclusive. I think you can do and be all of these things at once. You don't have to decide for, I'm only going to make a difference in this this tiny area. You know, you do as much as you can, and obviously some people have more time than other people, and some, you know, some people have more access to the media than other people. You know what I mean? It's not, you know, it's not about punishing people if they, you know, just have time to do one tiny thing. I mean, you know, the kind of cuts that we're seeing at the moment and have been seeing. I mean, I was just reminded, Sarah was talking about the absence of creches. You know, they've closed all the creches at universities, you know, systematically, you know, making it much harder to sort of integrate childcare into work, even at the same time as women and single women are being pushed back into work increasingly. You know, we live in this kind of neo-Dickensian, you know, fantasy in which, you know, philanthropists are going to save the arts and, you know, everyone has to work. You know, it's insane. I mean, and, you know, we know that the public sector cuts are disproportionately affecting women and children, you know, because women, you know, are massively represented in that sector. You know, I mean, you know, because Thatcher sort of destroyed industry, we now live in a kind of primarily knowledge and service-based economy, which is also, you know, we can talk about the feminisation of labour. You know, it's quantitatively there are more women in work, and qualitatively that kind of work tends to be associated with things that women have historically been supposed to be good at, so communication and, you know, caring and all of that. And, you know, there's a real sense in which typically feminine attributes, whether or not they are actually feminine attributes is another question, are being sort of devalued at the same time as they come to sort of found the majority of the type of work that's available. So, you know, it's women's work has always been precarious. It's always been, you know, this model of kind of last hired, first fired. But now that sort of model has been generalised to everyone, you know, including men. So it's like the bad model of women's work, badly paid, insecure, you know, sort of liable to end at any given point with no benefits, is now basically the model for all work.
Yeah, although women are much more affected.
Exactly, and women are still far more affected, you know, negatively affected. I mean, you know, who's still at the top of all of these industries?
Absolutely.
Speaking about the film industry or
the financial industry. The universities, you know, the financial industry, absolutely.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, it's a kind of, like, multiple level punishment, basically. Yeah.
I was interested if people feel this, that they are functioning also on this level of disavowal that Zizek so helpfully theorised for us, whereby we're aware that something is wrong and that we don't want to associate ourselves with it. It's a practice which goes against our political ideals. Yet we do it anyway because of a kind of, like Mark Fisher's idea of capitalist realism. We do it anyway because we have to. It's the only reality. It's too enormous to think how we could change it on an everyday level. And therefore, we live in this kind of split consciousness of functioning where you know something's wrong, but you do it anyway. And I see that all the time in institutions and workplaces.
Yes.
And I wonder if there's a way, in terms of coming back to the notion of daily subversion, of trying to critique that structure of disavowal every time we see it.
Yeah, I really think there is, and I don't really like this argument particularly about disavowal. I mean, I think you'd be fully conscious of the way in which you're sort of behaving to other human beings, for example. And I think, you know, if we, you know, you don't need to call it utopian, but there are ways in which you can have genuine human social relations under capitalism. You can be friends with people at work. You can be nice to people you don't know. You can help people you don't know. You know, in a way, almost as if we lived in a different structure. You know, I think you can see hints of a better world precisely in those kind of human interactions which do involve things like care, compassion, empathy, and all of those things we're supposed to think are, you know, pathetic and not worth bothering.
And you see that in your workplace?
Yes, sometimes. I see it between my students, let's say. You know, the relation between me and my students, the relationships between my students and each other. I mean, even though they're supposed to be competing and, you know, endlessly measured in exams and all of that and competing for jobs afterwards, you know, they're actually incredibly friendly and supportive of one another in a way that, you know, good neoliberal subjects aren't really supposed to be.
Right.
You know, and I think if I do want to defend notion of subversion, it would be that. It would almost be, you know, look at the way we can behave in human ways towards one another, even though we're supposed to be constantly pitted against one another and competing, and, you know, the way in which employers will pit, as you mentioned, you know, women with children against single women. You know, it's very useful for them that if there's no solidarity between those two groups, because it means that they can, you know, exploit and resentment.
So you think that there's moments of there's cracks within the structure.
Yeah, of course.
Whereby human relations can come has
absolutely
can be the site of subversion.
I think it takes an awful lot of work to make people not want to work together and not want to be nice to each other, not want to cooperate. It takes a massive amount of propaganda and kind of, you know, endless reinforcement that all we're supposed to be as consumers and individualistic.
So you don't think
privatized.
You don't think that precarious women in institutions are set to they're set against each other, that the structure
no,
of competition.
No, they are, but they don't. You know, but they don't have to behave like that. I mean, they don't behave like that. You know, actually, once you realise that you have far more in common with every other precarious worker, you know, there is a sense of solidarity. It's organising that sense of
it's galvanising the solidarity that we have to work on.
Hasn't Facebook got a lot to? Isn't Facebook very important here? You're talking the kind of solidarity you're talking about, and the fact that students aren't in competition with each other, they're very much in conversation with each other. And I mean, that seems to me the huge difference between our generation or my generation and the one beneath, is that this is an amazing amount of sort of political activity going on Facebook.
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, I don't know if it's, you know, there's nothing sort of inherently politically useful about Facebook and Twitter. I mean, they can
except that all the, you know, the revolutions recently have been Facebook initiated.
In terms of speed and organisation, they can be very useful tools, but they're not neutral tools. I think we have to be aware of that. You know, and Facebook and Twitter will close down things and block things when they feel, you know, that things are getting politically too out of hand or whatever. But I do think in terms of a kind of, you know, maybe a sort of a hint of a form of solidarity or virtual forms of solidarity, yes, because in a way, you know, this idea of communication on a sort of horizontal level is very kind of interesting at the kind of human level. It's like saying we all have this capacity, you know, that
I think,
of interiority, you know, feelings of interiority and insecurity, perhaps, I mean, can be exacerbated by the internet, obviously, quite a lot of the time, but they can also be, you know, shared online, you know.
I think it's a move, it's a move from verticality. I mean, feminism has always kind of used vertical structures, the mother-daughter relationship, say the use of the word waves and generations. And obviously that's been crucial, but it's also problematic to use verticality.
There's also sisterhood and kind of...
Yeah, I was about to say, sisterhood was something which circulated majorly in the second wave. Yeah. But we're at a stage where there's a new laterality, if you like, a new kind of way of communicating that's neither rehashing that very particular notion of sisterhood in the second wave and dispensing with vertical structures. And it is to do with technology too, but it's also to do with somehow the way communication can move so quickly. And I think that laterality is something that we need to build on to galvanise collectivity, because I'm less optimistic than you in terms of collectivity and solidarity. I think that's a crucial problem within feminism, because it's not a homogenous group, you know.
But I think, I mean, overcoming those divisions, you know, supposed divisions between, you know, women with children, women without, you know, the waves,
race, class, international situation.
In principle, we have to be working to overcome those divisions. I mean, not to say that there aren't loads of different feminisms and you can't, you know, be interested in one thing or another, but just, you know, if it is to mean something as a political project, it has to have certain shared collective political goals. Otherwise, it's nothing. Otherwise, you know, Sarah Palin can call herself a feminist. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or anyone can, you know, otherwise it becomes meaningless.
Yeah.
So I think within that diversity and all of those, you know, internal, very important critical questions about race and class... and motherhood and all of those things, there has to be some sort of
shared unifying agenda.
Yeah.
I mean, and what would you say? What would people say that shared agenda is? I mean, because it's exactly what keeps getting lost, and the splintering off of feminism is in effect weakens our possibility of subversive intervention. And it's this galvanising of what is that common concern? What would you say it was? The analysis of liberal capitalism?
I think the analysis and critique of capitalism is central, and also, you know, it. That sort of focus would hopefully prevent some of the more, you know, dubious elements of the history of feminism. You know, if it's transphobia, for example, you know, the way in which, you know, you endlessly get moored on discussions of essentialism and who doesn't and who counts as a woman, you know, that's, you know, far less interesting to me than the way in which people who are positioned as women are treated in a certain way within a certain economic system. Do you see what I mean? So we don't have to have the question about who counts as a woman, because it's the single most pointless conversation ever. It's not politically useful at all. And I worry that sometimes these, you know, feminist discussions get caught on single issues like, you know, the sex industry or, you know, pornification, or, do you know what I mean? Like, they get kind of blindsided, and sometimes they don't look at these questions as historical or economic questions, but simply as, like, moral questions.
Well, I think there is a place for those conversations.
Yes, there are, but they're kind of limited on their own terms.
Well, it's a matter of those conversations being laterally joined with the other conversations to produce a systematic structural critique. Mm. And in a way, we're at a time in history where maybe that is possible, that we're at a stage where there's a kind of crisis in neoliberal capitalism. So maybe this is a time of hope for feminism to kind of re-galvanise a different agenda that does join up all the splinters feminist conversations about difference and language and pornification and all of those moral conversations with a kind of idea of a new future, a yet to be, like Irigaray once said. So maybe we could end with people thinking about a kind of moment of hope, of a galvanising of a new feminism. I mean, Juliet Mitchell once said feminism is the longest revolution, you know. Mm. It's obviously going to go on and on and on and adapt to the social, economic and cultural conditions that we're in. Mm. So do you feel that we are at a specific time of hope for a new galvanising feminism? So
something is changing, for sure. You know, having been alive for long enough to have seen these kind of waves now, of, you know, obviously being educated by a generation of women who were the first wave of something is happening again.
Yeah.
It's in the psyche, it's in the cultural psyche. You can feel change. I don't know if I can identify with the vision of abstraction that you have, Nina, but I think it's helpful to think about it like that as well.
Do people want to have a last word? We've got 2 minutes left to just say whether you believe that there is something actually happening that's different, that is actually specifically different with feminism.
I think there absolutely is, and there absolutely should be.
Nina?
I say, look at what's happening on the streets. Look at the involvement and the role of young women in the protests and the forthcoming protests.
Yeah.
And, you know, a sort of lack of fear about getting involved in politics. Look at the way women are rising through the ranks of union memberships, union leadership.
Certainly in the Middle East we can see that change can happen peacefully.
Yeah.
Transformation is a possibility.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you so much for joining me today, Sarah Turner, Nina Power, Frances Wilson, and happy International Women's Day.
Thanks.